Hello everyone and welcome to the Indian Startup Show. It's a weekly podcast about Indian startups, entrepreneurs and what they're building. I'm Neil Patel, the host, and thanks for tuning in. If you need something to do during these challenging and difficult times and want some inspiration and creativity, check out Skillshare.com. It's an online learning community with thousands of classes in design, business, tech and more. Anyone can join the millions of members in the community to learn cutting-edge skills, network with peers and discover new opportunities. Try premium free for 2 months. Check out the show notes. And also, you're going to love creativelive.com. They have online classes in photography, art, design, craft, marketing, business, and entrepreneurship, which is available on demand 24/7. Check out the show notes for more information. On with the show.
And now, it's time for Raghav Gupta of Nimble Labs to crystallize his dream into a presentation that will convince and win over the judges. But first, he's up for some teasing by the panel.
Good afternoon, all. So, hi, my name is Raghav.
Raghav, I have a question for you.
Before I start?
Yes.
Yes, please go on.
You are 23, you look handsome, you have such a lovely smile. Do you have a girlfriend?
I would not like to say that on stage.
So, that means you're looking out. Go ahead, Raghav.
So, hi, I'm Raghav. I'm one of the co-founders at Nimble Labs, where we are making everyday eating conveniently possible for you. There does not exist a convenient way for young working professionals in fast-paced cities to eat truly healthy, preservative-free food every day.
So today I'm catching up with Raghav Gupta. He is the co-founder of Nimble Labs. He came on the show in November 2017. His team have built an amazing personal cooking assistant called Julia. So we'll talk about that. He also talks about his appearance on TV that you just heard. He talks about how they've developed the robot since we last spoke. He talks about raising finance, setting up offices in China and California. He talks about why they are changing the market focus from India to the US. He gives great advice on customer development and how they qualify customers. Very important. Talks about how they demoed the robot at TechCrunch Robotics Conference without paying the £1,000 for a booth. That's a great story. And finally, we have some music at the end of the show and much, much more. So please enjoy the show. Thank you. Hello, Raghav. Thank you for coming back on the show today.
Hey, thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me over.
What's been going on since we last spoke to you in November 2017?
Oh, so the last time we talked, we were still just maybe a bunch of 5-6 people trying to build a bot that could cook food. Mm-hmm. We're still a bunch of people trying to build a bot that cooks food, but now we've grown in number and have expanded across 3 different offices, raised venture capital from some of the brightest entrepreneurs and investors in the venture ecosystem, mm-hmm. and are now finally ready to put our robot in the houses of people across California to get their feedback and continue to improve this before we're ready for mass production.
Excellent. So it's a curry cooking robot called Julia. Just explain to our listeners how it works.
So when we started out about, when we last talked about 17, 18 months back, this were the idea we had was of building a curry cooking robot. But now as we continue to develop it, we realized that the same technology that is used to cook curries can actually be used to cook not just curries, but almost everything that can be cooked on a stovetop. Now we're expanding our repertoire of recipes into stir fries, pastas, soups, salads, rice bowls, and pretty much anything that can be cooked on a stovetop. So now we don't call it a curry cooking robot, but we call it Julia, your personal cooking assistant.
So in terms of the stir fry, how would that work then? Would I have to chop my own vegetables then, or do I need to download an app?
So because I don't have a visual, the best way to explain this would be that we have a cooking, that we have a coffee machine, but for food.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
So it looks just like, it's just like a coffee machine. You load in the ingredients, you tap cook, and out comes your food instead of coffee. You have to load in different chopped or prepped ingredients into different compartments. There are compartments for oil and water. There are compartments for solid ingredients like milk, broccoli, florets, meat, grains, or anything else that you can think of. other smaller ingredients like spices, herbs, vinegars, etc. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So we have more or less all ingredients covered. And then there's a so there's a place for you to put in ingredients.
Okay.
There's a place where a pan goes in. Pan has a stirrer inbuilt.
Okay.
And it is housed on top of an induction cooktop. So as soon as you choose a recipe on the on the screen of this apparatus and load in the ingredients that are that the screen tells you, it just cooks the food automatically by putting the right ingredients into the cooking vessel or the pan at the right time, heating the food for the right temperature, stirring the food, monitoring changes in heat, monitoring changes in color, monitoring changes in doneness, and basically giving you a very delicious meal without you having to spend time either stirring your food or watching over your food or just standing near your food.
No, sounds exciting.
That, hope that explains.
Yeah, no, definitely explains it. And you also appeared on the CNBC India's version of Shark Tank called Pulse the Venture.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience of being on TV.
That experience was really nice. It was the first time we appeared on national television. It was fantastic to see myself on video pitching to a bunch of investors. Mm-hmm. What that experience did was it helped us build much more clarity around our message. Like, how can we deliver the same message in a very crisp manner to people who don't have a lot of time to listen to you?
Mm-hmm. We played a snippet at the start of the show because the judge asked you if you had a girlfriend before you even pitched.
Yeah, and the good news is my then girlfriend is now my fiance.
Oh, okay.
We'll soon be getting married.
That's good news.
People who were interested in Julia found CNBC's coverage to be a credible source of truth, that Julia or what these people are building is actually a business and not probably a hobby project. Did help us get a lot of inquiries on the website.
Mm.
So people did reach our website and signed up to see our product. But then we changed our market focus from India to the United States. So those inquiries were basically only helpful to us to the extent that we could use them as a trial market in India.
Okay, and why did you focus from India to America then?
We realized a lot of real challenges that were not visible in India, but were more visible in the US, primarily because of the way that the workforce is structured here versus in the US. In India, we don't have a dearth of manpower. There is never a shortage of manpower, and most people have cooks who can who come to their place every day, maybe even three times a day, and cook food for them.
Mm-hmm.
For a very affordable rate. I in Bangalore, I think I pay not upwards of probably like $120 to $130 a month for a cook that comes to my house 6 days a week, two times a day,
mm-hmm.
and cooks for four people. In the US, whereas manpower is scarce,
mm-hmm.
And it's hard to get to cook on your own. So whereas the next best alternative to Julia, to a cooking robot here, is the domestic help. In the US, the next best alternative is cooking yourself. And so people feel that there's a greater need of a robot that cooks food for you.
Cool. What's the business model now? Because last time I spoke to you, I think it was like $300. Has that changed, or is it now a new business model?
Yeah, that has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, when we were... so because we shifted our focus to the US market, so when we shifted our focus to the US, we realized that customers were much more demanding, and they demanded a higher quality product as opposed to the kind of product that Indians demanded. So we have improved the reliability, the safety, and the quality output of the food in our prototype. With that, the price of the prototype has also increased. We have not yet zeroed down on the pricing of the robot,
mm-hmm.
as of now, but what we're doing is we're giving out the robot to early users, mm-hmm. or alpha testers, mm-hmm. for $75 a month as of now.
Mm-hmm.
What this does is it It helps early testers get a feel of the product, mm-hmm. use it at their house without committing to it long term, because it's still an early product and not a fully functional one. And what it gives us is insights into how consumers are using it, how often they're using it, what problems they're facing, mm-hmm. so that we can continue to build a better product before shipping it out to the mm-hmm. masses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds interesting. So when you're getting feedback, you know, what insights have you gained? Anything surprising?
The most interesting thing we've realized is that control over food trumps convenience for most consumers. What I mean by that is people want to have a certain control over their food. They want to control the amount of ingredients that are going inside their food. They want to control the amount of spices. They want to control the taste. They want to control the flavors and other things. They basically want to ensure that their food is cooked exactly the way they want it. And as long as that happens, they want convenience.
No, interesting stuff.
In obtaining that same food.
Yeah.
What we were perhaps doing earlier was we were making it easier for them to obtain food, which is giving them more convenience. But we were changing the output, which was we were giving them less control and more convenience. Mm-hmm. That has now changed. So what we now do is we let users. So essentially, users want to be able to change each aspect of the food, and we now allow it by letting them tweak the amount of oil, the amount of salt, removing a certain ingredient from the recipe, and so on. And that we do at a very in a very convenient way for them.
Mm-hmm. What's like the goals of the research then? What is it you're trying to sort of find out, as it were?
Yeah, so the goal of the research that we were doing was to figure out who is our earliest target market and who has the most dire need of getting a robot that cooks for them. Mm-hmm. And what stood out for us was that dual-income households who have no kids or dual-income households who have kids who are less than 10 years of age are the most time-strapped people who also want fresh food at home. And we found out the needs of especially people who had kids who were younger. We did not realize earlier how picky kids were when it came to food. Now we know that that they're really picky, and only the mothers know what sort of food their kid would like. And so the threshold of customizability or the levels of customizability that we were building in earlier have increased because of that feedback, that people wanted more customizability. We also understood the biggest value prop that people got out of Julia, which is the cooking robot. The biggest value props for these people who had kids was they saved a lot of time. Like, I'm surprised how super mothers or superhuman mothers juggle between work, between entertaining their kids, and between cooking food every day. And now at least the cooking piece is taken away from them and they save a lot of time. B, the second value prop for them is they don't have to default to eating the same four dishes that they've learned to cook every day. Now they get much more variety. Whereas earlier they would have had to spend time on YouTube or on recipe blogs to learn a new recipe and to give it to their family. Now families don't have to do that because Julia just gives them new recipes every single day without them having to learn them. And the third value prop that we understood was, as I mentioned, customizability.
Excellent stuff. And how are you capturing this feedback then? Is there any special software?
The way we're capturing this feedback is, so I'll tell you the process that we followed.
Yeah, go for it.
We realized that feedback and noise, it's very difficult for people to segregate between feedback and noise. And the way to segregate between feedback and noise, so the way to differentiate between feedback and noise is by differentiating who your customer might be and who your customer might not be. Anything that's coming from a person who might not end up becoming your customer is noise. So while taking feedback, the first thing we did was we qualified people who were most likely to be customers by getting them to sign up on our website. Mm. and go through some friction in signing up, in giving their email IDs, phone numbers, social profiles, zip codes. That was enough of a friction for them to show that they were really interested in this product. Second level of friction that we introduced in the process was by actually, people who were more likely to be customers were people who allowed us to come to their home and spend 1.5-2 hours at their home, you know, showing our prototype to them. People are private and they don't want anyone to just come home and show a demo of their product at their home. So people who signed up on a website and let us into their house to see the demo were most likely customers, and we listened to their feedback. The software we used was very simple recording, or the equipment that we used for getting this feedback was very simple recording equipment.
Yeah.
We carried a camera, we carried a gimbal, we carried a microphone, and we recorded all the interactions that they made with our robot. We recorded all the questions they asked us and got that back to our home office base, used an audio transcription service to extract all the audio and then basically work with it.
No, interesting stuff. A lot of listeners who may be interested in doing custom development on their idea. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give our listeners on that?
My advice to most listeners who are interested in customer development would be to first not talk about your product at all to the consumers. Maybe just get on a call with them or have a face-to-face meeting. Give them a broad idea of what space you're in and ask them questions around the problems they might have in that space. So for us, if that is a cooking problem, the way we would approach this in the initial days was we would go to people and we would say, hey, I'm Raghav, I'm from this food company, and we're trying to understand the problems people face during cooking every day or during consuming food every day, and I would just like to talk to you about the problems you face in the kitchen. Now, because we did not ever tell them that we were building cooking robot, they would not get biased and would very honestly tell us all the problems that they faced in the kitchen, whether it was pre-cooking prep work, whether it was the cooking work, whether it was the post-cooking cleanup, whether it was meal planning, grocery shopping, etc. They gave us an entire lowdown on all the problems that they had. So once you've abstracted your product away from these conversations, you get enough insights to focus on your product and build a product that only solves problems that people talked to you about without you necessarily introducing your product. That is step one. And then step two would be go back to the same customer saying, hey, you told me about these A, B, C, and you told me about these three problems, A, B, and C. I heard your problem and, you know, came up with this product concept. Like, don't build the product this way. Maybe just make a set of slides or a website. And so I actually came up with this product. What do you think about this product? Mm-hmm. And continue to hear out what problems they potentially foresee with your product. Once it is still in the sketch mode and they're continuing to give you feedback, only then you build the actual physical thing, which takes the most amount of time to build, and then let them use it and then continue to give you feedback.
Interesting stuff. No, that's good that. So you actually went over to San Francisco then, or California, and did the trials yourself. So you went into people's houses. What was that like?
So it was great because we had, so just like I was describing you the process, because we had ourselves gone through that process, talked to people, learned about the problems, shown them concepts, gotten feedback. The third time when we actually went to their house with a prototype or a product, we actually had nailed down most of the problems that they had in their kitchens. Mm-hmm. So now we were able to get a much deeper understanding of their problems. What we did was we drove across the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, San Diego, and demoed it to 20 or so families. We would lug around our 50-pound prototype in the back of our cars with all the debugging supplies and whatnot, and set this up at their house and have a very structured interview process with them about, you know, what they were liking, what they were not liking, how they were interacting with it, how they could see the product fit into their lives, and so on, and use that to continue to refine the product and give our technical team more insight. During the daytime, this is what we would do. Our product would also fail at times. And so during the second half of the day at night, we would just come back home, open the product apart, try to fix as many issues as we could, you know, and then on the next day, go back on the road and show the prototype to the next set of people. While we were doing this, we started understanding the language that that people resonated with, and ultimately also got at least 30 or 40% of the people we talked to pay us money to get this into their houses.
That's good.
So what's next is that we would put this in the houses of people, let them use it for an extended period of time, and see the kind of problems they face when they use it, not for an hour, but for an entire week or an entire month.
No, interesting stuff. You mentioned offices in China. What goes on in China, and you know, what were the challenges of setting up in China?
We opened an office in China because specifically we opened it in a city called Shenzhen, because Shenzhen is the factory for the world. All consumer electronics products, from the TV that you use to perhaps the phone you use, is manufactured in Shenzhen. So they have a very vibrant ecosystem around manufacturing, a design for assembly and for sourcing of components. So our prototyping cycles reduce multifold. Let me just give you a scenario. Scenario is, let us say we're building a certain part, and we feel that, and we realize that it requires a design change. Earlier, what would happen is we would require a design change. We would give it to a vendor. The vendor would make the design change in 4 or 5 days, ship it back to us, and the design change would reach us in say 7 or 8 days. So in a week's time, we were only able to make one design change. In China, what happens is that same design change is done in a matter of 2 days. So instead of one change a week, we're now able to do 4 changes a week.
Wow.
Which is 4x our productivity.
Cool. And can you now produce in bulk now that you've got this space in China?
We are not focusing on producing in bulk right now. We feel that it is very important for tens of people to be using our product and giving us very valuable feedback before we lock down some of the feature changes that we need to lock down. And only once we've locked down those decisions would be manufacturing in bulk. Mm-hmm. But we're still some time away from bulk manufacturing. Mm-hmm. It'll take about a year or more for us to do that.
A year or more. No worries. And you mentioned investment. I think it's your first round of capital. Talk about that. How much did you raise, and what was the equity?
So we haven't disclosed the amount or the equity that we had to divest, but we're currently funded by 0 to 1 Capital, Waterbridge Ventures, and Binny Bansal. 0 to 1 Capital and Waterbridge Ventures are VC funds based in India, focusing on startups that are really solving hard problems. Binny Bansal is the co-founder at Flipkart, which is India's largest e-commerce company. Company was recently acquired by Walmart for $17 billion. But not just that, we're also funded by Sameh Kohli and Akash Gupta, who are co-founders at Grey Orange Robotics, which is perhaps one of the largest warehousing robotics players in the world. Because most of our investors have been entrepreneurs themselves in one, either right now or sometime in the past, they don't just bring in capital to our company, but also a lot of valuable advice that helps us, you know, build this company the way it should be built.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good news. What kind of advice have they given you then?
For example, the Grey Orange Robotics is a robotics company which was started by 2 college graduates, mm-hmm. and is now worth about $500 million.
Wow.
And their most recent investor was Peter Thiel. And because the founders started straight out of college, built a robotics business from India for the global market, they very much understand the challenges that we also face and keep pushing us to solve some of those challenges this very early on. One of the very valuable advice they gave us was to set up the China office. Mm-hmm. We were not in favor of setting up that China office, but Samir and Akash really pushed us hard, saying that, you know, you cannot make this business succeed unless you get out of your comfort zone and open a China office. So that was one thing. The second thing they really pushed hard on was they pushed us to build the worst product that we can, but in the fastest way possible. Basically, they pushed us to ship whatever product we can and basically put it in consumers' houses. We had this grand vision of a product that would solve all problems that a consumer would have, but they advised us not to focus on all those 100 problems, but focus on the smallest problem that we could solve in the fastest way possible and just basically ship it to the house of 4 people, 5 people.
No, that's good advice. That in terms of the competition, then there must be other startups doing what you're doing. How do you sort of deal with the competition now?
Most of the consumer robotics startups that are solving problems in the food space are still in similar stages to us. So not many companies have shipped so far, because it's a hard problem to solve, to build something that cooks food for you automatically. So right now, we're not really worried about competition or even keeping track of what the competition is doing. We're currently only focused on building a product that cooks food for you in the most convenient way possible at the press of a button. There are a lot of companies.
Yeah.
They are spread across different nations, but currently we're not focusing on what they're doing so much.
Okay. And also, you demoed this at the TechCrunch Robotics and AI conference. It's been a big occasion for you. How did that go?
Yeah, that was really interesting because the Robotics and AI conference people, or the organizers, wanted us to pay. So for us to get a booth at the Robotics and AI conference, we had to shell out thousands of dollars.
Wow.
But we did not want to shell out those $1,000. So we basically displayed at the conference without shelling out a single
nice.
Without shelling out a single dollar. We were able to do that, and that was the most interesting part for us.
How did
what
you do
we
that?
Was
did...
We just drove to so we basically just drove to the conference venue with a prototype, because we were already doing these trials to consumers every day. We always had the prototype in the back of our trunk.
Oh, nice.
So we had no plans to demonstrate there. We just reached there to attend the conference, and then we were like, hey, outside the main conference, there are these tables, or there are these platforms where we potentially can put a prototype, and we also see plug points. If we just display it here, should they stop us from displaying? Well, they shouldn't, because no one knows that we haven't paid money. So let us just get it from the car, and we'll set it up here. And if anyone stops us, we'll just take it back. And luckily for us, no one stopped us. They found what we were doing interesting, and they probably thought that it was adding to the experience of the conference attendees. So they let us demo our bot there.
Oh, nice. That's good. That's a good one. That
also got us another TV feature, by the way.
Did it?
Yeah. So a firm called, a news channel called CGTN was making videos of the latest and greatest that was happening at TechCrunch. Uh-huh. And they sat through our demo and shot the footage and made it live wherever they're channels were.
Oh, nice. What did you cook?
Yeah, we cooked a rotini mushroom pasta.
Oh, okay. Oh, nice.
So it was basically a white sauce pasta with a lot of mushrooms in it. Mm-hmm. And people loved it. At the end of the demo, so there was also a food delivery robot company that was displaying there. And what we did was we prepared our pasta on the robot, then we put it into the delivery robot. Mm-hmm. And the delivery robot delivered robot-cooked pasta to the attendees.
Oh, nice. So at the moment, this is a B2C. Would you not focus on B2B? You know, you can go to offices, colleges, and sell this as well.
That is certainly a use case that we might want to explore in the future. Right now, we are currently solely focused on solving the home cooking problem. The reason for that is that the incentives of restaurateurs are not aligned with the incentives of people who cook at home. The incentive of a restaurateur is to deliver food in the fastest way possible and to earn the largest amount of profit, which means that they might not use the highest quality ingredients and even put preservatives in the food or use pre-cooked food, which is something that does not align with what we want. What we want is for people to eat the freshest food possible, have control over what ingredients are going inside the food, have full control on the traceability, and that is more aligned with the home cooking use case as of now. That being said, as we improve our technology, we might expand into B2B use cases as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're still doing the alpha trials. How long will you do the alpha trials?
Currently, the trials are on hold.
Yeah.
Amid the coronavirus situation. Mm-hmm. But as soon as it settles down, we will be on the road again. And we intend to continue to do these trials for at least a period of 8 to 9 months from now, because that data or that information will really help us build a product that then solves the problem of more than 10,000 people across. And we don't want to half-ass it. We don't want to build something that might give problems to a lot of people only because we were in a lot of hurry to ship the product soon.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned coronavirus. How are you keeping productive, as they say? Or are you being productive in this lockdown stage?
We are really trying to be productive, but it's hard, especially for a company like ours, which is not a pure software company. We have engineers who have to work on mechanisms. We have engineers who have to work with electronics. We have engineers who have to assemble different plastic parts and motors and, you know, screens and things like that together. So they need a working functional lab. And in lockdown state, even in a remote work from home situation, it's extremely hard for them to do that.
Mm.
The work has been affected, but we're trying to push hard against it and trying to use this opportunity to upskill our team by giving them more learning opportunities and give more output once they join, you know, their labs back. The second way we're affected is that we have operations across different geographies.
Mm-hmm.
And because movement across these geographies is restricted, movement of goods from China to Bangalore and movement of human capital from Bangalore to the US and vice versa, our development operations and our user trial operations are also affected.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we never talked about your co-founder on the last show. Who's the co-founder and how did you guys meet?
So my co-founder is Rohan Malhotra.
Mm-hmm.
The two of us went to the same high school together.
Mm-hmm.
And have known each other for close to 15 years now. And Rohan was a mechanical engineer. I was an electronics engineer.
Yeah.
And when you're doing something in robotic, the three things you need are mechanics, electronics, and software.
Mm-hmm.
So software is something that we taught ourselves and also hired people.
And in the early days, how did you divide up the roles?
In the early days, both of us were techies. So Rohan taught himself electronics and software and used to work developing the control systems of the robot, whereas used to act as a mechanical engineer and, you know, work on the mechanics of the bot. Although my training is in electronics and Rohan's training is in mechanical engineering, switching these roles even amongst ourselves helped ensure that we had a sounding board to talk to whenever there was something we did not understand.
Mm-hmm.
So earlier days, those were the roles.
Last few questions. How has this startup changed you then since we last spoke? Is it still exciting?
It is still exciting. How the startup has changed me on a personal level since we last talked is that working on my startup has made me become much more comfortable with uncertainty. So whereas earlier, not knowing what the future holds for me, like even that thought used to make me feel so scared, now that is not the case. Now having run the startup, I know that I am prepared for the worst, and whatever happens will be for the best, now more comfortable with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So that's how it's changed for me. Mm-hmm.
Before you got the capital or the investment, did you nearly run out of money then? Or
It was quite tough. Like, not having the money and still continuing to push hard was tough. But I'm really thankful to our team who continued to believe in us, took salary cuts, and continued to push hard, believing that the money would come. It was hard. It took us a lot of time.
Do you still get like people say, you know, what the hell is this? Why are you doing this?
Not really.
No.
I don't. Maybe people would have said that 1 year back.
Yeah.
Now, I don't remember anyone telling us, why the hell are you doing this? This does not make sense.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Good stuff. And last few questions then. You know, what advice would you give our listeners about building a startup?
Don't fall in love with your product. Fall in love with the problem that your customers are facing, though, and then obsessively try hard to solve the problem. Do not try to find a problem for the product you've already fallen in love with.
Mm-hmm. Great. And if people want more information on you and Julia, what must they do?
They could just go to our website. It's eatwithnimble.com. And our website would have most of the information they would need to stay updated. There's also a box where they could just enter their email address, and we'll send them a short digest every month to keep them abreast with the latest happenings at Nimble.
Awesome stuff. Excellent. And we're gonna play out with some music. This is your brother and his friend. Set this up for us.
Yeah, they're playing Wonderwall. This was about like 10 years back in high school when they decided to play this song on Teacher's Day.
Excellent. Raghav, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Neil.
Awesome stuff. Cheers, buddy. Thanks to Raghav for coming on the show today. And for more information, go to Nimble Labs, and hopefully I will speak to you next week. Check out the show notes for Skillshare and Creative Live links. And without further ado, we have some music for you.
Gonna be the one that saves me.